Unlikely Allies, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Connecticut Democrat Rosa DeLauro supports President Trump's push to renegotiate NAFTA, but don't call her anti-trade.
We are not opposed to trade. And though we've been painted as being opposed to trade, that is not the case.
Also, what if President Trump really does start a trade war?
A lot of us with a sense of history are very worried that we're about to take a detour down a road that we haven't been down in a very long time, and it's going to be bad for everyone.
Plus, why reggae star Alpha Blondy is now reading books on the radio.
I read somewhere that if you want to hide something to an African, put it in a book, because Africans do not like to read. And I thought that was pretty insulting.
All ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for joining us. We begin with more on President Trump's plans to impose tariffs on imported steel and aluminum today. Today, Mexico's economy minister promised retaliation on politically sensitive U.S. products. And Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has personally called Trump to register serious concern about the proposed tariffs. Of course, all this is wrapped up in the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA has governed the rules of trade between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada since 1994. President Trump often rails against the agreement and has called it the worst trade deal ever made. He campaigned on renegotiating the treaty, and he stuck to his word. The U.S., Mexico, and Canada have been busy renegotiating a deal for months, and Trump has some unexpected allies in his fight. The World's Jason Margolis starts us off today in New Haven, Connecticut.
Democratic Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro was at the Capitol when NAFTA was signed into law 24 years ago.
I started in Congress in 1990. I am in Congress for 27 years.
DeLauro, who represents Connecticut's 3rd District, opposed NAFTA from the start, fearing that the trade deal would cost her state and the nation jobs. She rattles off a list of what's transpired.
2004, in my district, we lost 300 good jobs at the BIC plant, which was in Milford. The company moved its razor operations to Mexico. We have another example with the Ansonia Brass and Copper, which had thousands of workers. Which
all told, it's been a steady decline of jobs in Connecticut since NAFTA took effect.
You know, look, and these are not my words. This is 100,000 manufacturing jobs in Connecticut lost since NAFTA. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 1994 to 2016.
Now, debates get heated about how many of those jobs can be attributed to NAFTA versus advances in machinery or other factors like China joining the World Trade Organization. Still, the downward spike in jobs is undeniable. DeLauro has become an outspoken congressional leader on trade. She wants a revised NAFTA to include things like tougher environmental standards and strong provisions for buying American goods. She's calling for the elimination of a corporation's ability to sue a government through an international arbitration panel, which progressives argue favors corporate rights. And above all else, DeLauro wants to stop the outsourcing of American jobs.
So when you outsource the jobs to countries that pay a lower wage, you do two things. You hurt American workers by their loss of jobs or the suppression of their wages. And at the same time, you're looking at people in Mexico, for instance, who are making pittance.
She wants to see stronger labor standards written into a revised NAFTA. And just as importantly, enforced. When DeLauro and others first brought up these issues more than 2 decades ago, she says President Bill Clinton dismissed their concerns.
We were very concerned about real loss of job, and now we have evidence of that loss of job.
DeLauro also clashed with President Obama over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a proposed trade agreement to cover 12 Pacific Rim nations. Today, DeLauro is putting her faith in an unlikely ally to renegotiate NAFTA, President Donald Trump.
It really is the best opportunity that we have. We do have an administration that said that they wanted to renegotiate. We need to hold them to that effort and to be strong in that determination. And I think you're also seeing a much, much heightened awareness of what that outsourcing did to people's livelihoods and to families, which was clearly demonstrated in the last election.
We're rooting for Trump to do the right thing. If he does the right thing, then certainly we'll give him the credit.
John Harrity is a union leader representing about 10,000 machinist workers in Connecticut. While he's rooting for the president on trade, he's not hearing much coming from the talks to suggest a better deal for workers is coming. Just more of the same.
These agreements are not agreements about workers, even though they impact workers directly. These agreements are about corporate interest and keeping their interests safe.
Harrity says he knows they can't get back to the good old days when he started at a manufacturing plant in 1979 in East Hartford.
When I went there, they were hiring people literally by the busload.
He says parts of Connecticut today look like they were struck by a natural disaster.
Miles and miles of boarded up factories and abandoned brownfield locations.
He blames poor public policies for this. And he says if they can't get a revised NAFTA with stronger provisions to protect the environment and workers, well, then...
As far as we're concerned, the best thing to do is just scrap the whole thing and go back to where we were.
Talk like that has many corporate leaders and economists worried. Economists have warned that tearing up NAFTA would be somewhere between damaging and catastrophic to the North American economy. Michael Klein with the Fletcher School at Tufts University points out that we enter into trade agreements to benefit society as a whole. Otherwise, we wouldn't do them. But he understands why NAFTA has been so vilified.
People who are hurt by trade are often hurt proportionally more at an individual level than the people who benefit. If there is import competition and you lose your job, that's a really big thing. If you can now buy a car from abroad that saves you a couple thousand dollars, well, that's a good thing, but that's not of the same magnitude as losing your job.
Klein says NAFTA has brought a lot more benefits than just cheaper cars or fresh, affordable fruits and vegetables all year round. Trade creates new export markets for American products, and it's actually propped up the American auto industry. All those inexpensive auto parts being made in Mexico have helped keep General Motors and Ford competitive in a global landscape, and that's helped keep auto plants in places like Michigan open for business. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro says she gets all that.
Look, I think trade agreements do create jobs. I believe in trade. I've wanted to change the rules of the road as we've moved along, and that's where most of us are coming from. We are not opposed to trade.
As for President Trump, he's repeatedly threatened to pull out of NAFTA entirely. DeLauro says she doesn't want that outcome, but she also wants to know, what's the plan? She says the Trump administration hasn't been transparent with Congress about the details of a revised NAFTA.
We need to look at that. We have the ultimate responsibility for trade agreements, and we are still not seeing these documents. Trust is not enough. You have to verify what and the devil is in the details.
She says President Trump talks a lot about helping forgotten men and women. But she says the president's tax overhaul and repeated calls to gut the Affordable Care Act have been betrayals of the working men and women who put their faith in him. That said, again, DeLauro says now is the best moment they've had in decades to push for a better NAFTA. For The World, Jason Margolis, New Haven, Connecticut.
Jason's reporting is part of our 50 States project. To find more of our coverage of how globalization is affecting America's economy, head over to PRI.org/50 States. That's 50 States. A lot of economists are sounding alarm bells about Donald Trump's apparent push toward protectionism and an all-out retaliatory trade war. They say history is clear that is a bad idea. Lee Brandstetter is professor of economics at Carnegie Mellon University. So am I right in thinking the last big push toward protectionism was in the 30s, right after the famous 1929 crash, stock market crash?
Well, that is the historical precedent that we're all afraid of. So you're absolutely right. In the late 20s and early 30s, there was a massive movement to protectionism. At that time, the Great Crash had already happened. Lots of people were worried about jobs. And so in this case, two Republican members of Congress, Mr. Smoot and Mr. Hawley, introduced a massive hike in tariffs that President Herbert Hoover thought about rejecting. But in the end, he signed. And that triggered a global trade war, which brought huge declines in global trade and made the Great Depression far worse.
So are you saying that protectionism ultimately made the Depression the Great Depression?
Well, it didn't make the Great Depression. There were lots of things going wrong. But the trade war that was begun then definitely made the Great Depression worse. It made the pain greater. It made the employment losses more significant. And that's a lesson that both Republicans and Democrats took away from this dark part of our history. And in the post-war era, you had both Democratic administrations and Republican administrations working together with Congress and our trading partners around the world to make sure that our post-war trading system was free and open to international flows of goods and investment. And that has helped bring prosperity not just for the United States, but for the world. And a lot of us with a sense of history are very worried that we're about to take a detour down a road that we haven't been down in a very long time, and it's going to be bad for everyone.
Certainly there were some less intense trade wars since the end of World War II. I mean, I feel like I've heard of some.
That's right. So actually in the 1980s, under another Republican president, Ronald Reagan, there was a series of protectionist measures that were imposed by the Reagan administration. But those were generally quite targeted and narrow. And for the most part, they weren't using the very broad discretion that President Trump is invoking under Section 232 of the Trade Act of 1962, which is what he's invoking to create these steel and aluminum tariffs. What the argument the president is basically making is that steel and aluminum imports are threatening our national security. And that particular provision of our trade law allows the president to do all kinds of things to limit imports that he deems threaten national security. And the law defines national security threats in such a broad way that a president can basically say just about anything is a national security threat. The problem with what the president is doing today is that his tariffs are going to hit steel imports that are mostly coming from our allies, including our defense treaty allies, nations like Canada, Germany, Japan, and South Korea, with whom we've had military treaties for decades. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to say that importing steel from one of your defense treaty allies is threatening national security. And if the United States can say that this is a threat to national security, then what's to stop our trading partners from invoking national security and preventing us from exporting the goods that we're good at making to them? This opens up a Pandora's box that's going to threaten U.S. exports for decades to come.
Before that Pandora's box is opened, I wonder if maybe Donald Trump is just talking and tweeting trade war bluster, and maybe we'll see something more like Reagan's approach to tariffs.
Well, one can always hope, and this is a president and an administration that seems to change its mind a lot. But Marco, my concern is that the president's rhetoric has been so strong on this issue, his threats have been so expansive, that it's going to be very hard for him to walk this back without making him look weak and indecisive. Of course, the problem is that if he follows through, then our trading partners have a real problem. Do they take this lying down, or do they retaliate in kind? And I think given their political and economic situations, they're almost certain to retaliate. So we're at least taking a few steps down that Smoot-Hawley road that we really don't need to be walking down at this time.
Professor Lee Brandstetter at Carnegie Mellon, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts.
Thank you.
And yes, European officials have already signaled they plan to retaliate against Trump's tariffs. Here's European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker speaking bluntly this past weekend.
Dass wir dies tun müssen.
We're also going to impose punitive tariffs. It's very easy. We will impose punitive tariffs on motorcycles, Harley-Davidsons, Levi's jeans, and bourbon. We can be that stupid.
So blöd können wir auch.
Just ahead on the show, the next steps for talks between the two Koreas. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. North Korea willing to relinquish nuclear weapons? Really? If you're seeing headlines today from the Korean Peninsula, they probably seem more than a little confusing. I mean, haven't we heard leader Kim Jong-un for several years now boasting about North Korea's nuclear capabilities, and now he'll dismantle them? We heard about this from a South Korean official after a delegation from the South visited the North and even dined with Kim himself before going home today. Officials also announced plans for the leaders of both nations to meet next month. Nothing like this has happened since Kim took power after the death of his father in 2011. Jean Lee is a Wilson Center Global Fellow based in Seoul, and she's also a longtime Korea's correspondent. So what is going on here, Jean? Did Olympics diplomacy work? Is that the headline?
Well, President Moon Jae-in certainly wasted no time in jumping on the opening that the sports diplomacy from the Olympics offered. And so we have to give him some credit there. He's really forged ahead with this policy of engaging North Korea. But the challenge for him, of course, is he has to do that while he's balancing the alliance, the relationship with Washington.
I mean, if we look at the optics of this, we've got these pictures of Kim Jong-un and the two countries' delegations. They've got these big grins on their faces. It looks like they're having a blast, quite frankly. And Kim apparently said he wanted to write a new history of national reunification. You spent time in the North, Jean. You've even set up an AP bureau in Pyongyang. Do you think this is the usual propaganda, or are you hearing something new?
This is major propaganda for Kim Jong-un. He desperately wanted these images because after focusing for so long on building up the military arsenal, the nuclear arsenal, he is turning his attention now to inter-Korean relations. One thing I'd like to point out is that in the years as he was being groomed to become leader and as he took over as leader in 2011, one thing that he did say that I think is notable is that his father and his grandfather died without having accomplished the signing of a peace treaty to end the Korean War. He walked into this role knowing that his job was to try to reunify the peninsula, or at least to sign a peace treaty with the United States.
But are South Koreans able to imagine a scenario in which Kim Jong-un is convinced enough of his own country's safety and security that he is willing to give up nuclear weapons?
That is precisely what people are skeptical of. We have been down this path before. The United States and North Korea have been negotiating over North Korea's nuclear weapons for 25 years, and it's only been a trail of broken promises. And frankly, South Korea and North Korea have had summits before. We had the first historic summit in 2000. I did cover that here in Seoul in 2000. And it was only 6 years later, after that summit, and in the middle of this period of warming ties, that North Korea tested its first nuclear weapon. So the South Koreans are a little bit more skeptical, I would say very skeptical this time around, but optimistic.
So here in the States, as we know, Donald Trump has been sending threatening tweets and stepping up sanctions. But today, in a tweet about yesterday's meeting, Trump said there's a serious effort being made by all parties concerned. Then he says maybe false hope, but the U.S. is ready to go hard in either direction. So bombs or peace. But it does seem somewhat charitable considering what we've heard from the president. What do you think these meetings mean for the U.S.?
I think this puts some pressure on the United States to make sure that they're not sidelined. There's also pressure on both South Korea and the United States to make sure that there's no rift in the alliance. North Korea loves to play a game of divide and conquer. They do like to play favorites, and that only works to North Korea's advantage. So if South Korea and the United States want to be smart about it, they want to try to avoid that happening.
Did Donald Trump's bombast and pressure work? I mean, is that why the two Koreas met at the table yesterday? I mean, brinksmanship can be risky, but it can also have dividends. How many people do you know are saying that's what's going on?
I think brinksmanship on the part of both Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump brought us to the point where we are now. I think the North Koreans used the rhetoric from the White House, from Donald Trump, to keep building its nuclear weapons program. And by building the program to the point where he felt comfortable that he could stop, in a sense, and claim success, allowed him to move on to the next step, which is to reach out to the South Koreans and discuss talks.
Jean, are you hopeful that yesterday's meeting is something the parties can build on?
We're just at the very beginning. I'm glad we're at this point. As someone who lives in South Korea, what we don't want is more tension. But where we go from now is going to be very complicated, very tricky. So again, like the South Koreans, I'm optimistic, but very cautious.
There is another summit next month. I mean, at least there's a date, right?
This is really interesting. It'll be the first time the North Korean leader is coming down to step on South Korean soil. So it'll be inside the DMZ, but on the South Korean side, and that's significant. It'll also be our first chance to really get a look at how Moon Jae-in will interact with Kim Jong-un. So there's a lot here to look forward to. But again, we've been down this path before. We've had summits in the past, and it's a very different situation this time around with North Korea's nuclear program being as threatening as it is.
Jean Lee, a Wilson Center Global Fellow, speaking with us from Seoul. Thanks very much, Jean.
Thanks for having me.
6 months have passed since Hurricane Irma swept through the Caribbean, leaving a path of destruction and human misery. The British Virgin Islands were hit especially hard. My BBC colleague Ali McBool went to see how the recovery is going.
It's shocking that so long after the storm, there are still some in the British Virgin Islands living in shelters, like those we found in a gym on the island of Tortola. Makiba Heskey was there cradling her nine-month-old baby, Mikkel.
We've been here like 5-6 months and nothing. It looked like it seems to me that everybody just gave up on us.
Irma was the most devastating hurricane ever to be recorded in this region. Barely a building on the island was left untouched. Boats were lifted clean into the air and dumped on the land. Mountains of debris have since been cleared and lots of construction's taken place, but Tortola now still has the signs everywhere you look that devastation was wrought here. Buildings without roofs, boats still submerged, many schools and even government offices still in ruins. And though it's desperately needed, tourism has suffered badly. For the most part, the main dock is empty. The two biggest cruise companies here have stopped bringing ships to the British Virgin Islands. It's meant people who worked in the industry for decades, like Rosalyn Hill, who was at the Peter Island Resort, have been laid off.
In peak season a couple of years ago, sometimes it looks like there's more boats than water. You can't see the water for the yachts. It's not a good feeling, you know, back then to compare it to now. It's not a good feeling. But, you know, I have to say, when we see a cruise ship, it's like light.
But light has been hard to come by in the past 6 months here, and there are very few yachts in the bay now.
A quick check-in on Caribbean recovery efforts with the BBC's Ali McBool there, reporting from Tortola in the British Virgin Islands. I'm Marco Werman. A former Russian spy, now living in the UK, falls ill after coming into contact with an unknown substance. There's no hard evidence yet as to whether someone tried to poison him, but there are suspicions.
You know, in this case, there is a motive in that he would be regarded by his former colleagues in Russian intelligence as a traitor.
That story still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It all happened on Sunday in the town of Salisbury in southern England. A woman was strolling through a local park and saw two people in trouble.
An older guy and a younger girl, looked like she'd passed out maybe. He was doing some strange hand movements, looking up to the sky. I felt anxious, I felt like I should step in. But to be honest, they looked so out of it that I thought even if I did step in, I wasn't sure how I could help.
Turns out they aren't a couple. It's a former Russian spy who worked for the British and defected to the West, and his daughter, Sergei and Yulia Skripal. Today, both are in critical condition in the hospital. My colleague, the BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera, joins me now from London. Can you tell us, first of all, Gordon, who Sergei Skripal is?
Sergei Skripal was a Russian intelligence officer. He was a colonel in Russian military intelligence. Details are a bit sketchy, but we understand that he was arrested in 2004 and then convicted in 2006 for spying, specifically for providing secrets for money to British intelligence, MI6. Convicted in Moscow and imprisoned in Moscow. And he remained in prison, and he was due to serve a sentence of 13 years until July 2010, when he was pardoned as part of that spy swap, which led to a group of Russian illegals who'd been operating in America undercover being captured by the FBI. The Russians wanted them back, and in exchange, the West got a number of people who were in jail on spying charges in Russia, and Sergei Skripal was one of the four who was released as part of that deal, at which point he came to the UK and Salisbury and lived a very low-profile life until the last few days.
Yes, yeah, so one possibility is that this might be an assassination attempt. By whom?
Well, I think if you look at means and motive in this case, then I think the finger does point towards Russia. But we should be clear, there isn't necessarily hard evidence for that yet. But in terms of means, well, you know, he fell ill after exposure to an unknown substance. You know, that's not the kind of thing that happens normally in a kind of criminal attack or even an organized crime attack. You might have a weapon or a gun used like in that situation. But we do know that the Russian intelligence services do appear to have used toxic substances in the past. And in terms of motive, well, you know, in this case, there is a motive in that he would be regarded by his former colleagues in Russian intelligence as a traitor. For having its alleged spied for the West and for British intelligence. So you can see there why the speculation leads towards Moscow, even if at this point there is no necessarily conclusive evidence or hard facts supporting that.
He had been pardoned, though, in the spy swap in 2010. I mean, what had he been doing more recently that might attract the attention of somebody who didn't want him around anymore?
Well, that's a question that's been asked. And the truth is he's had a very low profile. It's not as if he had been campaigning against Vladimir Putin openly or in any way publicly or had been involved in anything that we know of that would have brought him to their attention. And that's why the timing is slightly mysterious. And you return to that possible motive of revenge and the allegation that he was a traitor from Russian intelligence. There may be another explanation. I mean, there could be another explanation, but it's not one that at the moment is obviously apparent.
So there are a lot of comparisons to the death of Alexander Litvinenko, the former Russian spy murdered in London in 2006 with radioactive polonium. Do these two cases actually line up? Are there parallels?
There are certainly similarities because if you look, the Alexander Litvinenko case was a former Russian intelligence officer like Sergei Skripal who fell ill after exposure to an unknown substance. So you can see the parallels there. Certainly some differences in the Litvinenko case. He was a much more vocal critic, an outward critic of the Kremlin and was very active. Also in the Litvinenko case, he was poisoned by a radioactive dose of polonium in a cup of tea. Now, there's been no suggestion at this point and no sign of fears of radioactivity in this case. Mm. So certainly some differences and they don't look the same, but certainly the similarities are striking.
Gord Carrera, the security correspondent with our partners at the BBC in London. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
We know you come here to understand how the U.S. fits into the rest of the world, but recent events here have us thinking a lot about our unique American problems with guns, as mass shootings have pressured Washington and individual states to debate gun control measures. We had some questions. How did a military-grade assault rifle like the AR-15 become so popular? Was it pop culture, or was it something even more obvious? Did the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq glorify this weapon?
To fight, whatever shape the battle takes. Because as long as there are battles, there will always be Marines.
The answers, it turns out, are not simple. Aaron O'Connell is a former Marine who now teaches U.S. history at the University of Texas, Austin. And he says gun companies have not hesitated in using war and soldiers to sell their product.
Well, there's gun companies named Wilson Combat. There are magazines called Tactical Life. There are companies hawking tactical combat training to civilians and selling military vests and holsters and helmets. And even if you go to, say, the Armalite website that makes the AR-15, they advertise that their rifle is ideal not just for sporting or home defense, but for quote-unquote duty. Now, what duty would a civilian perform with a military weapon? I think that's all an effort to effectively appropriate the language of military service and to turn the buying of a firearm into some form of patriotic duty, and I don't think that makes any sense.
So if we're talking recent wars and their effect on the AR-15, I mean, there's some history to go over here. So the AR-15, it was banned for a while. Clinton banned it, and then the ban was lifted in 2004, kind of sunsetted. What happened then?
Well, gun ownership went up. More obviously, people started buying the AR-15 and other weapons that originated as military weapons. But the real statistical correlations start in 2008. The ATF keeps really good numbers on this, and we know that from all their
alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. The Bureau.
That's right. Sure. Yeah. So the ATF keeps data on all the guns manufactured in a given year. And that data shows that between 1986 and 2007, roughly 30 years, those numbers hold steady at about 2 to 3 million guns being manufactured per year. And then in 2009, right after the election of Barack Obama, gun production jumps to 5 million guns per year. And by 2013, it doubles to 10 million guns per year.
Yeah. So why do you think that is?
I don't know. It's hard to make generalizations about why an individual makes a specific purchase. But it's pretty clear to me that there's some political lobbying that's relevant here, because as soon as President Obama is elected, the NRA became much more alarmist and aggressive in insisting that the government was coming to take people's guns.
I mean, it does seem really important, those two data points that you mentioned there. But I want to get back just to the wars and what kind of effect that had. Like, the movies and images and other types of media that came out of the coverage of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, it did bring more awareness about the AR-15. Do you think in 2004 the general public knew about these weapons? Would they have known if it weren't for what we saw on TV and in movies?
I think so, but I think most people thought about those weapons as exclusively military items. So I think what does change in the 2000s is that more and more people start buying weapons that previously they had in their minds thought of only as military weapons.
And how similar is the AR-15 to weapons used in the military? I know it kind of like came out of the M1, right, early on.
It's a replacement for them. They're effectively the same weapon. So the AR-15 is developed as a replacement for the M1 Garand, and that is later adapted into the M16.
And Aaron, you were in the Marines. Have you used both of these firearms?
I've never fired an AR-15 because I've always fired M16s.
Gotcha.
and later versions thereof. And I'll be the first to say it, that guns are fun. It is exciting to shoot weapons, but the military puts us through fairly extensive training before they let you shoot them, and then has really quite elaborate rules for controlling your access to those firearms. And what bothers me here is that gun manufacturers and the gun lobby want to appropriate all the honor of military service and sort of layer that onto their civilian gun sales, but they don't want any of the reasonable precautions that the military itself uses to make sure that accidents don't happen and that people don't do things they shouldn't.
Aaron, if I think about the different ways this gun, the AR-15, could have come into the mindset of Americans, there are obviously the movies. I went to see Black Panther, and there were 8 trailers, all featured big guns. TV commercials for the armed forces, all featured guns. And then video games like Call of Duty, we see how the military is portrayed there. When you look at all of this together, what do you think is the effect on sales of AR-15s?
I don't know how you can link the actual films and the representations in popular culture to gun sales. Mm. I think you can make a general statement that the more that that weapons are celebrated in our everyday life, the more that they are part of the narratives of what it means to be American or to be brave or to be a man, the more that those stories are going to seep into all elements of our culture, including our children's culture.
Aaron O'Connell teaches history at the University of Texas, Austin. Thanks very much for being with us, Aaron.
Thank you very much.
A story now about the persistence of ethnic tensions. In Kosovo, ethnic tensions flared into war back in 1998 when Kosovo Albanians fought a bitter campaign against Serbian forces. It ended about a year later when NATO airstrikes drove the army of Slobodan Milosevic out of Kosovo and international peacekeepers went in. In 2008, Kosovo declared its independence from Serbia, something Serbia has never recognized, and neither have the Serbs living in northern parts of Kosovo. The divisions are especially stark in the split city of Mitrovica, where Serbs live on one side of the river and Albanians on the other. But reporters Valerie Plesch and Veronika Zaragovia found a place where Serbs and Albanians do mix. Valerie starts our story.
Suleiman Naziri has a policy in his supermarket. No Serbian products allowed. He proudly points out products made in Kosovo. His store is in Ferizaj, a city in southern Kosovo that's mostly Albanian. The war in Kosovo happened nearly 20 years ago, but it's still fresh in Naziri's mind. He says during the conflict, thousands of Albanian women were raped by Serbian soldiers.
Ushtria dhe policia serbe ka masakrue me qindra e mija shqiptar.
People were massacred, kids were poisoned, and he cannot bear the thought to have a Serbian product on his table.
It's not just about the war, though. Naziri says if Kosovo doesn't put its own products on the shelves, this struggling young economy will never advance.
On the other side of the country, about 50 miles away, Filip Markovic co-owns a restaurant. He's a Kosovo Serb. And when he's making purchases?
Honestly, I prefer to buy Serbian products. From the business standpoint, it's always like quality and price.
But he does make exceptions now and then.
If something is made in Albania and it's good quality, then I have no other choice than to buy it.
Like most Serbs here, Markovic doesn't recognize Kosovo's independence from Serbia.
Is it like stolen from us? We still like the secession was illegal. We were never asked about the secession. It was completely one-sided. And you won't find, you will be really hard-pressed to find a Serb who recognizes Kosovo independence.
Markovic's restaurant is in Mitrovica, the city that's split between Serbs in the north and Albanians in the south. On the northern side, people speak Serbian and they use Serbian money, the dinar. Just across the Ibar River is South Mitrovica, where the population speaks Albanian and uses the euro.
And one of the first things you see when you cross over the bridge is the ETC supermarket, Kosovo's version of Costco. Albania and Kosovo flags hang on the walls and Albanian pop songs play overhead. And yet, this is one of the few places in Kosovo where Serbs and Albanians come together. Not to socialize, just to shop. Safet Samani is an Albanian shopper, though he speaks Serbian. Most Albanians over the age of 40 speak Serbian too. Salmani says the only opportunity to meet again are these big supermarkets.
Another shopper, Milica Andrić, agrees. She comes from North Mitrovica, the Serbian side.
The point is that they can learn here, both Serbs and Albanians, that we can shop next to each other and like not fight, which is an improvement for our communities.
She explains to us that most Serbs and Albanians still don't mix outside this store, but at least
they can still coexist in the same aisle.
She says it's ironic that NGOs have put so much into peace building here, but it's happening in a small way in this supermarket.
This contact here is not driven by the outsiders, not driven by the money, but basically driven by people's needs and consumers actually need. It's not no longer just Serbs or Albanians, it's just that they're consumers.
But after the Serb customers go through the checkout, they don't linger. They take their groceries, get into taxis, and make the trip back over the bridge. For The World, I'm Veronica Saragovia.
And I'm Valerie Plesch, Mitrovica, Kosovo.
In just a minute, story time on the radio with reggae singer Alpha Blondy. First, though, a little something from Down Under, a story about what some are calling the oldest message in a bottle ever found. A family in Western Australia stumbled on it as they were walking on a beach north of Perth. Tanya Illman says she was in the sand dunes when she spotted what she thought was garbage.
I was actually really upset and horrified by the rubbish, and I decided I'd pick up a couple of things and just throw them in the bin. And I simply bent down and picked up the first thing that was at my feet, and it was that bottle.
Inside, there was a damp scroll with a message written in German. Tanya and her husband, Kim, weren't quite sure what to make of it, so Kim decided to investigate.
I spent days on it, and I initially started researching the bottle, found some evidence that it came from the Netherlands, probably held gin or Geneva, whatever that is. I've never drunk it. It's a herbal alcohol, I think.
Eventually, the Illmans turned to a local museum in Perth for help. Researchers there focused on the scroll instead of the bottle. Long story short, they traced the message to a German ship that sailed through the Indian Ocean back in 1886. Its crew had thrown the bottle overboard 132 years ago as part of an experiment by the German Naval Observatory to understand global ocean currents. The note simply asked the finder to please send it back to Hamburg. We'll try to update you if the Australians follow through on that request. After my dad retired, it seemed he wanted to spend the rest of his waking days lost in a book. not a bad thing at all. And it turns out that's how one of Africa's best-known reggae stars, now in his 60s, is spending his time. Except in his case, he's reading to others on the radio.
La cinquième montagne de Paulo Coelho. Les hommes et les femmes d'Akbar suivirent en procession le groupe de gardes qui amenait l'Israélite jusqu'au pied de la cinquième montagne.
That's Alpha Blondie reading Paulo Coelho's The Fifth Mountain on, where else, Alpha Blondie FM in Abidjan, Ivory Coast. My BBC colleague Sasha Gankin recently asked the reggae star why he started the reading project.
I read somewhere that if you want to hide something to an African, put it in a book, because Africans do not like to read. And I thought that was pretty insulting. So when we got our radio, I decided that I'm going to read books to our listeners to teach or try to reach the youth and make them understand that they have to read. We started with simple books, okay, like books that they study at school. And then we added some other books that they don't teach. It's not everything that you learn at school. On Alpha Blondie FM, you read with your ears. It is an African tradition, the orality, telling stories, like in the village. So if you want to catch people's interest in what you're doing, you got to be on that radio. Those who do not know how to read can listen. So we discovered that many taxi drivers, bus drivers, have chosen the hour of our show. They stop their cars, the taxis, just to listen.
They stop?
Oh, yeah. Okay, because they don't want to be disturbed, okay? We read some African books like Amadou Kourouma, Allah n'est pas obligé, books like John Steinbeck, La Perle, The Pearl, okay? Ernest Hemingway, The Old Man and the Sea. And we read many other African authors.
So you started 3 years ago, yeah?
Yeah.
So since 3 years, how many books have you read?
35, including the Bible, the Old Testament, the translated from Hebrew to French, and the Quran. The Tanakh, the Old Testament, is 1,808 pages, and the Quran is 604 pages. We wanted our listeners to make their own idea, the discernment, to know what is good for them, what is not good for them.
You yourself, when did you start read? Have you been always passionate about reading?
Oh, yeah. I was not mingling with people a lot. So I was a weirdo, okay? And I love to read novels. And then I started reading books like André Malraux, La Condition Humaine. Oh, I did not understand at the time when I was younger the philosophy behind those books. But I read Edwin Cleaver, A Black Panther. I read a book about Janis Joplin. I used to love Janis Joplin a lot.
You are really a truly passionate reader.
Yeah, because reading books allow me to visit a slice of the brain of the writer. It's a kind of voyeur, you know? Okay, some knowledge, again, some wisdom. When I talk with my friends, you know, I love to talk about things that I read.
Are you receiving any feedback from your listeners?
Yeah, they tell me, Alpha, I love it. Last time, you know, you were reading something very complicated, but it was very passionate. I say, what is that? Stephen Hawking, From the Big Bang to the Black Hole.
Une brève histoire du temps, du Big Bang au trou noir, par Stephen Hawking.
People thought that musicians are dummies, okay? Besides singing and dancing. The fact that I started reading, I think, changed their mind about our profession. And for me, it's a way of giving another dimension to our musical career. You can be a musician, but you are not bound to only do things that concern music. You can do other things. I hope that our listeners will be more open-minded and to give another direction to the life of the children. Learn. Read.
Reggae great Alpha Blondy speaking there with the BBC's Sasha Gankin. I got to say, his reading project seems a lot less stressful than writing politically charged tunes that get co-opted by rebels in the Ivorian army. That's the old life of Alpha Blondy, one that he told us about back in 2002 after a coup d'etat in Ivory Coast. The army mutineers paid him a visit on Christmas Day to basically pay homage to the songwriter whose music they believed was in their honor. Alpha Blondy recalled that his daughter answered the door.
She said, "Oh, Daddy, Daddy, I just want to congratulate you." I said, "For what?" You know? "Well," I said, my daughter, "you are too young to understand. This is Africa. You don't know how people change their mind. And I don't want to be crucified."
We'll close today with some less political sounds, more in line with where Alpha Blondy's head is at today. One of Alpha Blondy's big hits, Sweet Fanta Giallo.
Fanta Giallo, ooh, ooh, Fanta Giallo. Sweet, sweet, Fanta Giallo, ooh, ooh, Fanta Giallo. Fanta walking on the rainbow now. Fanta shivering in the moonlight way. Fanta hugging me on the mountain top. Fanta kissing me on the burning rocks.
Ivory Coast reggae superstar Alpha Blondy brings things to a close today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.